Hello, I'm Chris Lisher, and welcome to Turning of the Wheel, an intelligent, lively discussion on astrology, art, and adventure. Timing is everything, and as the great wheel turns, we are best prepared when we are best informed. Join me as I explore the current planetary alignments and offer insights for coping with change. Educational, informative, enlightening, the Turning of the Wheel is a welcome pause in your daily swirl of constant change. Through intelligent discourse, inspired guests, and educational segments, I will help to enlighten your knowledge of astrology and guide you to accept change as the great wheel of life turns. Call in with your questions and speak with some of the greatest visionaries in the time-tested practice of astrology. Turning of the Wheel, Astrology, Art, and Adventure with Chris Lisher, each Thursday, live, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, on Contact Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Turning of the Wheel. My name's Chris Lisher. This is a show about astrology, art, and spiritual adventure. I have to say that today we are going to be breaching into a ground of artistic, evolutionary, visionary responses unlike you've ever seen before. My guest today is, in my press release for my guest coming on, I included the line otherworldly, and I think that it'd be safe to say that there's really no one else in the artistic world, or in that matter, who is quite like my guest. Unique is an overused word when it comes to him, but he certainly has every characteristic of being a true visionary, and unlike anybody I've ever met in my life, he is a true dynamic force for change and for creativity. His name is Paul Loffoli, and he's an artist out of Boston, and I encourage you while you're listening to go to his website, which is www.loffoli.com. It's L-A-F-F-O-L-E-Y, and you'll get a real good idea about what he's all about. Paul is an unusual visionary artist who is drawn on so many different aspects of what it means to be a human and to be part of the universe that it's almost impossible to try to find the right superlative for him. It almost looks as if somebody actually took a plug and plugged into him, and he has everything in his mind from quantum physics to alchemy. It's a remarkably detailed, very rich, artistically rendered artwork that just branches into every realm of verbs and words and dialogue and color and rhythm and touches on all the major senses. And I'm so honored to have him on my show today. Paul, welcome to Turning of the Wheel.
Hello?
Hello, there you are. Okay. I said, welcome to Turning of the Wheel. So I was explaining to people that when I first met you and when I first got turned on to your work, I had no way to really describe it to someone other than to show them, and I think that that's pretty much accurate. But yet, when you see it, I, for one, definitely get it. And I'm wondering if everyone gets your art, if you understand what I mean. Do you think that there are people who just don't quite get it?
Well, I've got two types of people. People who respond to it emotionally, and visually, and don't understand a word, even though I put all the words on the painting. And then other people who don't respond to it emotionally or visually, but enjoy the words and know what's going on. So that the question for me is, how do I get them both together in the same room?
Yeah, that's a very accurate way to put it. I mean, when I look at your paintings, and I encourage everybody to go to www.loffoli.com, it's L-A-F-F-O-L-E-Y, to get a better idea. There's quite a bit of wonderful, elaborate artwork. The way to really appreciate this is to see this in person. Now, Paul has a standing exhibit. He's represented by Kent Gallery out of New York City, and he's on his way to Europe to do a tour over there. And he is constantly in his studio working, and I've been there, and these are enormous paintings that require enormous amount of concentration and depth and detail and concentration that is almost inhuman. I mean, if for lack of a better word, it's superhuman, I guess would be a better word, because there's such amazing amount of detail. There never seems to be a mistake. Every line seems to be perfectly rendered. And the overarching themes are everything from quantum physics to astrology to the internal workings of the human body to the connectedness to mechanics to architecture. I mean, is there any themes that you really don't draw into your artwork, Paul? I mean, they just seem to be so widely diverse.
Well, I don't think so, and I keep coming up with new themes. I remember the first time that I had my chart read by Dorothea Lind.
Your astrology chart, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He noticed that I had Venus in the 12th house in 13 degrees, 26 minutes of Virgo, and that I had Virgo rising, but I'm also a 12th house Leo, and then I have a chart that is a fixed grand cross, mm-hmm. meaning that the sun and the moon are opposite each other, and Mars and Uranus are opposite each other, all at 90 degrees to each other. And so she said, forget the rest of your chart. The only thing you have going for you is that with the Neptune and the Virgo ascendant, you're capable of dealing with cosmic themes and turning them into finely detailed work. Now I never had anybody sum me up in a single sentence like that before, but I figured was pretty accurate.
Yeah, you know, with a grand cross, what you've got is you've got what in astrology what we call constant tension, and it's that tension, that stress, that sort of promotes someone to move. It sort of motivates them to create.
It's a fixed grand cross.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. A fixed grand cross is even more so.
Yeah,
and then you've got Neptune on the ascendant, which is very much of a dreamlike world where you enter a world of cosmic a cosmic reality, which is otherworldly. There's no question about it. You know, that's why I call this the mystic dimension, simply because of the fact that I see you as sort of you sort of breach that land of mysticism, and yet you've got this wonderful sense of dimension and clarity that is very clear to anyone who sees it. Anyone who can appreciate line and form and function and color will meet. Be immediately drawn to the complexity of your work because it is so finely rendered, and it takes sometimes some of your paintings have taken up to 3 years to create, and they are enormously resonant. I mean, they certainly pull you in, and it's not the sort of painting that you can look at and I mean, I guess let's put it this way, it's the sort of painting you can look at again and again and again and always find something new there. Now, when you're creating this stuff, do you consciously create that complexity, or is this just sort of a stream of consciousness coming out of you?
Well, I know that the paintings are going to have to be detailed in order to deal with what I'm doing. And so it's also the fact that as a symbolist, I noticed in researching what the 19th century symbolists did, they took a long time to do their paintings. You know, like Gustave Moreau, who did the Chimera. You know, if you ever go to Paris, you can see a studio, which is now a museum. It's near the Opera House. And he worked 20 years on this painting and never finished it.
Mm.
So it not only are they physically larger than a person, they're longer than most people have a sense of their own existence. In other words, probably like every 20 years you change completely. And so that if you don't do stuff within that 20-year period, you're going to be something else. Only the point was, with Moreau, he kept on being a painter. He was the teacher at the École des Beaux-Arts, and so that he had a sense of change, but he had also a continuity in what he was doing, and so would allow himself to take all that time. Of course, like a lot of artists now, simply can't afford that luxury, because it is a real luxury to take a long time on a painting.
You need to have a patron almost.
Yeah, right. I mean, you go to a gallery, and the guy says, "Well, that looks good. I want 200 more of those." You know, so that they're interested in selling your art like shoes, you know,
right.
as opposed to letting you actually do what you do. That's what I love about the Kent Gallery, is that there's no imposition on my mind or work habits.
Yeah. Now you know, you made an interesting point there about when a painting is done. You know, looking at your paintings and the degree to complexity that you go to, I could almost argue that, or maybe you can too, that maybe perhaps you never really ever finish your paintings.
No, I do. You know,
do you reach a point where you know it's done?
Oh yeah, right.
Yeah.
I think that's what when something is an artwork, the artist knows when it's done,
mm-hmm.
and so that if you keep on cranking it out, you know, beyond that, you'll basically just ruin it.
Yeah. Now, when you finish a painting and you look at it, and you can say, you know, this is blank. You know, do you have that sort of definition for your paintings? Do you say, well, this is a representation of, you know, the birth of a nebulous star? I mean, or whatever. Do you have those sort of terms that you use?
Well, I start out with the title at the top of the painting, which I put right on there.
You start out that way.
Yeah.
You already know what it is before you begin.
That's right.
Yeah.
So
have it in words too. It looks like always
I try to combine the words and the images so that they go together completely. You know, like I will change words, move lines of type around, shorten them, lengthen them. You know, so that they fit in the spaces that I want.
Yeah.
So that it's actually the opposite of the way people do lettering on a computer or a linotype, where they set up something to begin with and just put it in. In other words, I have to start working with the words and then they resonate with something else, and so the sense of the line changes because it's responding to some other part of the painting, and I find that it makes the thing more coherent, and it's adding to the meaning, and then of course the words elicit imagery, and then sometimes the imagery elicits words, so that it's not like some friend of mine said that he hoped one day, you know, in some museum, all the letters would fall off, so you could see what I really do. And I said that's got to be the absolute misunderstanding of what I produce, because I make sure that doesn't happen. Because I remember at one time in some place, some little kids were picking letters off of it. And so I had to make sure that I glued them down properly, so that doesn't happen. Yeah. But the thing is that I never want to have a thing that says, well, that I hope the letters fall off. No.
No, of course not.
They're part of what it is. I mean, because a letter is a visual element. I mean, if we start language from a cuneiform, you know, which is those little thin triangular shaped things that go into a clay tablet and then get frozen into there, and then you know, other languages form from that, and of course, like all the Oriental languages are a pictograph. You get hieroglyphics that
right.
meant the same thing.
Well, all letters yeah. are a derivative of a symbol of sorts.
Of course.
Now,
Yeah.
Now, when you start with words, and the words aren't necessarily always words that are part of the common vernacular. They may be words that are Latin. You've got words that come from many different esoteric forms. When those words go down, you start with words as your entree, so to speak. Does that sort of lead you on the path to where the painting goes, or do you already have that painting composed in your mind, and the words are simply a way to start that sentence?
No, it's a combination. I try to think of it as that each painting is a page of a book.
I see.
And so that I work the way a writer would work, only I'm working with images.
Mm-hmm.
And that as the thing goes together, I keep the tension between discursive writing and spatial impact the images. So
yeah,
the temporality and spatiality are working together rather than one eschewing the other.
Yeah. Now, what would that, when you combine all these together, as you have, you say, in sort of a sense of being a book, how, what would that story be about? What would that book be about?
Well, it'll be me inside of a sphere, placing pages on the surface. And since the sphere has no limit, you know, to its radii, the sphere can just get a little bigger each time I do some more stuff. But ultimately, I don't want to be considered as having, you know, recent work or early work or current work, you know, that kind of thing, which simply defines a slit in your existence where stuff passes through, and as opposed to having all of it resonating to each other, so that paintings that were done for me years ago work well with things that are done now. I have a painting of Rudolf Steiner, which is 45 years old, and people think that it's contemporary because I have it out. You know, I'm going to go to Dornach, to the Gerdianum, to talk to people at the Anthroposophical Society. You know, because I actually wanted to join that, because it's like, I think it's almost the last esoteric group that has been continuous since the 19th century. In other words, it's outlived its parent organization. You know, the Theosophical Society, and has expanded. So that it involves architecture, painting, sculpture, writing. I mean, you know, like if you look at what Rudolf Steiner did, you're going to see a Renaissance person.
Right. And that is all an offshoot of the same sort of philosophy that is sort of an extension of what creativity comes to and what it means. Now, when I mentioned earlier the concept of you creating a painting, say, 35, 40 years ago, mm-hmm. and a painting today, you put those two together, you'll see a definite consistency in the messaging, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because I think that what I tried to do all my life is do something that's transdisciplinary. It's not multidisciplinary. In other words, it means that it combines all forms of knowledge in the same way that a child who starts to learn about things, you know, in nature and the people around them, that they don't make differences. They don't define history as opposed to geography or mathematics. You know. They just start learning things, and for quite a while, it combines. And
I
so it's only later when you go through academia that you get slotted into different things. So that I just never did that because I've always had a real problem with with education.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are some trends in schools now where they try to link the art to get the different disciplinaries together. They try to bring the history in with the literature so that they are contemporary in the time when they're studying. So it's taken this long to get there. Now you mentioned that
that's probably why people like my stuff now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you were way ahead of your time in that regard. Now, you know, you mentioned that you, these are sort of a story, and is it really? Well, not a story may not be a word, but it's more of a reflection of knowledge as translated through you. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's information, and I found that as a way of doing it, it bypasses the conscious critical powers of say, editors of book publishing companies. Because if I said the same things just in words, you know, to try to get them in books, probably it wouldn't be published.
I see.
But having worked that in with the painting so that I can put a painting up in a gallery and people can't avoid it because they know they're supposed to go to galleries and museums and see things. And then so their eyes pass through it and look at it, and then they say, well, wait a minute, wow, I'm getting taught something. you know, that sometimes that people don't want to know.
Right. Now, when you but those the images and the ideas that you put forth in any one painting seem to have. I mean, I can resonate on a very deep level the connection there. I'm not sure that that's readily apparent to most people. Do you find yourself having to explain your paintings quite frequently when you're in galleries?
I do. I do give lectures,
yeah.
And I can talk a lot. I mean, like I can talk to nonstop for 6 to 8 hours. You know, in lectures, I'll do a slideshow with 80 slides. It'll take that long because I don't time myself on how much to say about one of them, you know, because mm-hmm. some of them I say more than others, and that those things I start to figure out what to write down as commentary to go with the paintings and that sort of stuff.
And you've got a seed of a thought that you start with. You start with a seed. Give me an example of a seed that you might have that you've got. I know you've got paintings floating around in your head that you haven't created yet. Give me the seed of one. What one might be?
Okay. Well, I'm now suddenly interested in what NASA's doing. You know that there are things on the moon and Mars that that people are discovering like Hoagland and other people, and that we're moving off the Earth, and we're getting into healing capacities that have to do with living in a completely different way. So how would you heal somebody that is living in outer space and doesn't have an immediate connection to, like the way I do, the Massachusetts General Hospital. You know, I'm down the street from that.
Right.
This involves mind physics. You know, where you're connecting mass to consciousness, and how that operates.
Yeah.
That's through psychotronics. I mean, there's a lot of words connected to it. But I don't think anybody yet has figured out how you actually connect consciousness to mass.
And no, they haven't.
but the thing is that if we get off the planet, we're certainly going to need to know that information to survive.
Yes, I think you're right. And you know what I think also it is? I think that there is a shift in a vibration. Now, you know, you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy. You know, we're way beyond food, clothing, and shelter, and we are elevating up that pyramid. And I think that as we elevate up that pyramid, we are increasing our vibration, which allows us to bring in information at a much different level that strikes our subconscious and allows us to, assimilate things in new ways that we hadn't in the past. And clearly you are on the leading edge of that because of how you've been able to take words and art and put things together. Now, for those of you in the listening audience who haven't seen Paul's work, I encourage you to go to www.loffoley.com. It's L-A-F-F-O-L-E-Y. We're speaking with Paul Loffoley today. He's a visionary contemporary abstract artist of the highest order, and his work is displayed prominently at Kent Gallery in New York City, and he's headed off for Europe at the same time. I just wanted to get that in. We do have a toll-free number. I'm reluctant to open it up, but I will just in case someone has a burning question. It's 1-877-230-3062. Too, if you've got a question for Paul. But Paul, you know, your work has this richness and complexity that is you know, it's not architecture, but it's got everything about architecture. It's not, you know, it's got so many different facets to it that it's sort of in a class by itself. Architecture plays a very big role.
Well, that's where I got most of my visual training other than having been a painter since I was 4 years old. You know,
right.
I actually never went to art school because my father tried to stop me from doing that. Even one time, he grabbed my arm when I was painting a painting down in the basement of our family home, and I kept thinking to myself, "Well, if he tries to stop me now, wait till he leaves the room, I'm going to go back to doing it." You know. that's a strange thing to do to a kid.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is the last thing you want to do. If you want them to do something, you don't take it away from them.
Right.
You know, it's very, I kind of see where that comes from. I mean, it's clearly that you have that architectural sensitivity, and I know that you are an architect. Interestingly enough, for those people, Paul was responsible for designing part of the World Trade Center. And it was an interesting story because I remember when I met you and we were speaking about it, there was an interesting part about that whole concept, in as much as they built in parts of the building that would allow them to destroy it if it had to be destroyed at one point.
I was working at night for the architect Frederick Kiesler, after I got kicked out of the Harvard Graduate School of Design. The next day I was in New York, and so he said, well, I can't pay you much, so you have to go get a day job. And I wandered around and finally found one at a place called Emery Roth & Son, who in the architectural trade is called a pencil, meaning that it's an office that has all the staff and all the fixtures. And so a big-time designer can come into the city and take it over and then do a building and then leave. And then the next guy shows up. So at the time that I was there, they were hosting Minoru Yamasaki, who came from the Pacific Rim. You know, he was head of his architectural office in Seattle, but then moved part of it to Chicago, across the street from the Sears Tower that was going up at the same time as the World Trade Center. He wanted to make sure that he knew how far that guy had moved it along, so that he could be considered as having the tallest buildings in the world, at least for some time. And so I'm in there working on, I think it was floors 15 to 45 in Tower 2. And nothing had been built. No, the so-called bathtub hadn't even been thought about at this point. That's the place where you remove the muck that occurred in that space on the west side, the West Side Drive down in...
Where they put the footing for the building.
Yeah, because they had to build a thing they call a bathtub where you put piles side by side, so it made a wall.
Right.
You know, and then they could dig out the stuff and they used that to form Battery Park City. You know, because before that, You went down the West Side Drive and you saw a lot of docks sticking out in the water. You know, so this was actually taking that stuff that they had developed, more than 100 years, where people, when they first arrived at Manhattan as an island, they came in at that small end. It's an alluvial deposit where the Hudson and the East River meet.
Right.
And so it's like the inverse of a delta. And so then they began to realize that it would be possible to build something there. And so I had learned when I went to Brown that Antonio Gaudi, the famous architect from Barcelona.
He's a famous, he did the Sagrada Familia and all
those odd
buildings in Barcelona, for those of you who don't know. Right.
That he was called upon to do a grand hotel for New York City. And it turned out that the spot that people call Ground Zero is where he wanted to put it. And that area is actually owned by the Knights of Malta. You know, that's an organization connected to the Catholic Church.
So the actual ground where the World Trade Center is owned by the Knights of Malta. So it's under a 99-year covenant, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so people who claim that they own it, they don't live as long as 99 years. So it immediately reverts back to the church till they get another renter. But anyway. Being in there, we met Yamasaki when he showed up, and so he was kind of standoffish from the whole thing, and so at a certain point, he just walked away from the whole process, And so what was a design group in name only suddenly had a real job. And so I started designing these floors and discovering that too much area was being taken up with the served space. You know, the service space, you know, like the elevators. And then to get people from the ground up to the top floor required three banks of 18 sets of elevators.
Right.
And that's a huge hunk out of the floor. That was all those buildings were a square acre, 212 by 212. And part of his selling point for it is that he was going to do the best that you can do in landscaping, for dividing, office landscaping, meaning that you can move the chairs around, you can have temporary partitions, and you can have companies that do that. Well, it turned out that didn't work at all, and so they were back to small rooms, along the outer edge of the building they were just boiler rooms, but they changed all to computers. And as a World Trade Center, you could have easily done the whole thing by taking a 5 mile diameter circle over in New Jersey and have it all in one story building, and done the whole thing that way.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
What I was going to say is that as I was putting this thing together and trying to satisfy clients and going through this tension of the inability to get enough space together in one place. So I even suggested that every fifth level would have bridges welded from the interior major four columns to the other tower, and sell them as so that a company would work on both towers, and they could go across on the bridge instead of going up and down on the elevators, which is a waste of time, and people tend not to do that. Well, also, while I was there, I started to realize that there were engineers going around and asking where should you put demolition devices. And I said, when the guy came to me, I said, why? The thing is, it's still a piece of paper. You know, there's nothing built. Why would you want to demolish it? He says, well, this is the 60s, you know, like that. And so we know that when people come to New York, 6 months later, they come back to the same address and there's a new building there. So how do you do that? Well, you have to load the building to begin with, and then you have an electrical devices that simply set it off. So people were shocked when the thing happened, and since you had more bolts rather than welding involved in it, and you had it eliminated a lot of the asbestos blocking to fast track the whole building. That when some part of that electrical system that was reserved entirely for the demolition was hit, the buildings came down like pancakes, and even Building 7 that was not hit. And so to this day, I can't understand why Emery Roth or Yamasaki's office was not contacted about that, because how he got these people to do this is that when he was servicing Saudi Arabia, he actually created the Ben Laban Construction Company. They were a small construction outfit, and since his ego was so huge, he wanted to make sure that he had people that would do exactly as he said, and work for him. And he made them, basically billionaires.
So do you think that that was a pre-planned event, and that whole thing may have been laid up ahead of time?
No, no. I don't think that it started out as a terrorist condition.
Yeah, but knowing that made it certainly an easy target, right?
Well, I mean that's what say conspiracy theorists would do that. But I think it was something that was just typical of the times. I mean, they did that for other buildings. And then what they would do is that they would put drop a tarp over a whole building, and so when they set the thing off, all the dust would be confined. I mean,
right.
I think that's what gave Christo, who used to wrap buildings,
his initial
imagery.
Yeah, I remember that. You're listening to Turning of the Wheel. My name's Chris Lischer. We're talking with Paul Loffoli. He's a contemporary abstract artist who is of an amazing complexity and deep vision. We are listening to Contact Talk Radio. You know, Paul, when I look at your work, you know, you certainly see a great sense of detail, which anyone can see if they go to www.loffoli.com, which is LaffoLey.com. You can get a very good sense of the work there. I mean, when you are sitting there drawing this stuff, what sort of themes recur and come to life in your work? I mean, you've got certain themes. What are the things that you draw on to get this work to a spot? I mean, are you delving into areas?
Well, okay. I try to do the simplest compositions possible, which, of course, is a mandala.
A point,
which is a bindu, you know, where everything collapses into that point, and then it unfolds to it. So I've always used the mandalic structure. I rarely go outside of square format. So if I do a 6-foot painting, it's 6 by 6 by 6. You know, like that on each side. And in doing that, I find that it's easier for me to unload, as it were. You know, to get all the information out.
Yeah, it's very interesting because you've got that. When you have the mandala, you've got that geometry of the degree there, which allows you to find that perfect harmony between when the lines intersect and then the way they come back together.
Yeah.
It's very, very easy for that in that regard.
So,
and that's what allows you to pull that in.
That when you have, compositions that require, funny balancing, you know, like one a large part to a small, the way that they teach composition in art schools, that frustrates me, because I can't get started on anything, because if I had gone to art school, I would have flunked out, because I simply can't work in the way that's presented, where you're concerned with only the material and the visual, and so that nothing that they want nothing else to have happen. I mean, like friends of mine that taught at local art schools would come in and look at my stuff and say you can't do that, and I said, I can't do what? You can't use words on your paintings. And I said, words and images are the oldest visual elements of all.
Mm-hmm.
And so that what you're doing is you're denying me half of my existence.
Right. I mean, the words in themselves, you know, the whole essence of symbology is translated by the simple letters. I mean, letters are symbols. They're no different than an astrological symbol or a glyph or anything else like that. They are all connected,
but,
and they have...
Sometimes one word is worth 1,000 pictures.
Absolutely. That's very true. That's very good. I like that. Do you think that there's a sense of... do you believe that the universe and the way we are structured and what happens... Do you think that that's all defined by a sort of a divine mathematical logic or formula? Do you think that, or do you think it's beyond that?
Well, I think that mathematics, like anything else, is creative. And so it keeps altering so that... That things like books on sacred geometry and all this kind of stuff don't see the essence of what it is. I think that's really the mathematics of death. Like where 0.382 to 0.618 of unity, when that moves through your body, you know, when you mature, you know, from the top of your head to navel, to the bottom of your feet, that you're starting to die. The hard parts of reality are subject to the logarithmic spiral or the equiangular spiral. And so, you know, people often design buildings and stick a half of a logarithmic spiral shell into the wall as if they're being organic, and this has to do with living stuff. It has to do with stuff that's dead, like trees die out at the edge at the bark. In the middle where the juices are running, it's not subject to anything. So the slug that's inside a shell is not subject to any metric mathematics. It's more like dynamic exercises in an advancement in topology, because that's where the new parts of mathematics will occur. And I think also it'll be the way in which people finally figure out how consciousness connects to mass in a continuity.
Right.
Because you certainly can't define it through any metric mathematical form.
You think there's a mathematical formula to the reason, and there's an actual mathematical or chemical response to how we arrive where we are. And consciousness is probably reached by a vibrational element of some sort. It appears, I think, don't you?
But I'm saying that to describe it through mathematics means to many people that you're going to use numbers to do it. Numbers kill. It's like if you emphasize awareness and then don't have mass involved, awareness will kill. You know, it's like part of meditation. That you can destroy things with it. That's how people do negative prayers
at each other. Yeah. You know, Paul, you know, one of the things that strikes me about your work, it almost looks otherworldly, and that's the word I've used to describe you. Do you somehow feel at any point that you are a conduit for some sort of energy from another part of the universe?
Well, I never started out thinking that until 1992 when my teeth started to fall out and I was going to try to get an implant, you know, in the jaw.
Right.
And so I went to the Beth Israel Dental Clinic, and they said, well, you know, like, we can't use those small x-rays that people usually get that are taken of the person's teeth. So you're going to have a CAT scan. And so I went over there and did that, and as my head was going through the hair dryer from hell, the clinician that was working on me started asking me funny questions. Said, like, have you ever had your neck broken? I said, up to that point, I've only had a collarbone, when I was like 7 years old. And so I said, no. And then he started saying, well, have you ever been shot? And I said, why are you asking me this question? He says, well, there's something in your brain. And I said, I hope it's brains, you know. I said, but what else? And they said it looks like a bullet or a cartridge, you know, the way the Egyptians did that form that the Napoleonic translators of hieroglyphics call a cartouche, which
okay.
is actually a French word for a cartridge. That it was something that was three-eighths of an inch long, a sixteenth of an inch in diameter, and rounded at both ends. And I said, that does not sound like a bullet, because a bullet, when it's fired from like escaping gases,
right,
you know,
it was
propelled in one direction, and then it bursts. You know,
right.
even if you don't use the dum-dum bullet, that all bullets will act like that, you know.
They'll disperse around where they enter,
yep.
And you'd have a point of entry in the back of your head, right?
Exactly. And so then he started. I said, in answer to my question, he said, "Well, I happen to belong to MUFON, you know, the Mutual UFO Network, and I think if if you've answered my questions the way you did, I think we may have an implant here.
And, now, when you say an implant, do you think that you have, I mean, if that was there from birth, and it was always in your head,
yeah.
and you have never had any point of entry, and it's a, and it sits in your brain, and it's a small cylinder,
yeah.
it could be an, it could be a transmitter, an antenna.
Well, it's that I went to in Medford, in around here is where they have MUFON, a local chapter,
right?
And so a physicist from Tufts University was one of its members, and so he looked at the pictures and said, "Well, I think what we have here is an example of a nanotechnological laboratory, because any civilization only 1,000 years older than ours would have commercialized nanotechnology, and so that they would have created biomechanical seeds for this and buckshotted parsecs of space." Because what's the use of going someplace to pick over planet by planet if there's nothing there or the, there's just animals or something? They want to know, is there intelligent life? Is it good to eat? You know, all this kind of stuff. And then what is the world view that these critters actually hold? So that they may have done that and then sent these things that are so small that they would enter any place on the skin of any organism and go to some of the ventricles in the brain, meaning if the thing set up shop there and then began to take the ambient atomic particles, because we're always coming apart at the seams, you know, atom by atom, and those are replaced, that you could actually create from those atomic debris, you know, like a thing that did a number of functions. Not that it would be like bird banding, you know, or putting something in porpoises. No, because we're just not even a speck of light, billions of light years away to another civilization.
I mean, yeah, how else?
So that it would actually give them a chance to observe a world view other than theirs, and to where it is in relation to its complexity, and it's like, are they ahead of us, behind us? You know, all those kinds of things. Right.
How else would you explain that situation? I mean, it is a medical phenomenon. Now, have you been to a doctor? Have they tried to figure out what the reason for that is there?
Well, they every once in a while, I keep getting x-rays in my head, and it's still there. It's never hurt. You know, it's not like Whitley Schreiber talks about stuff being put up his nose, you know, and that when the surgeons try to remove it, you know, it slips away. Well, the clinician who talked to me first had a connection to an operatory, and he said, "Can I bring you in now so we can open up your head?" And I said, "There's no way you're going to do that. You're going to take one of those little round saws and take a plug out of my skull and start having brain pudding for dessert."
No.
Yeah, right.
Now, Whitley Strieber was the man that wrote the book about communion, and
yeah.
You think about it, he was a writer, so he was a great way to get a message across because he had access to that, and
right.
he could easily be someone who would be sort of like a harbinger to sort of bring the message of what's coming. Do you think you're in the same category? Do you see yourself as sort of a vehicle for bringing a message?
Well, I think, like, I was going to talk about my design for a time machine, but the time's running out here.
Yeah.
And so that there was one part of it that if you were going to go or have contact with an alien time, say 50 billion years into the future, you'd have to have something similar to a time suit In the same way that we go into outer space, we have a spacesuit.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So what it would do, it would be an early warning system for a change of worldview, because, you know, oftentimes people will come in here and say, well, what's new? And I say, well, you've been looking at us for the past 10 years.
Right.
So your perception and your conception have to be resonating together in order to, you know, get a sense of connection. So you get a new worldview going.
So do you think that you have a new worldview, or you think you're the messenger for a new worldview?
Well, I like to think that I have a worldview that makes some sense. I'm not being a proselytizer about it. It's like that I think that that when people start to do that, that's when their message actually begins to fail, because they become extremely rigid.
You're more open. Yeah.
As part of my time machine that way, or the time suit, is I had a thing called the Agnosticon. It's a device to allow a person to believe or disbelieve any proposition instantly. Because if you were in outer space, you don't know what the hell's going on. And so that if you carry beliefs that were formed at 6 feet above the surface of the Earth, out a light year away, the likelihood of it being utilized in any way would be a pretty low degree of probability, I think.
Yeah. Well, now, as you move through this whole concept and stuff, what do you see sort of happening as you move through this? I mean, do you think that this allows you to bring some sort of insight into where we are? Do you think things are different now? Are we at a crossroads in life? Are we at a place where things are dramatically changing in the world?
Well, I think that a worldview is related to a theory of history, of course, and so that I've always thought that that we're now in the third stage of modernism. You know, say the first one, was like the Bauhaus and heroic modernism, and that went up to July 15th, 1972 at 3:23 in the afternoon, when the Igo Pruitt buildings that were designed by Minoru Yamasaki blown up,
right?
Because those were examples of heroic modernism that were totally failed, and they got the CIAM, the International Congress of Modern Architecture medal, and then the AIA medal as being perfect building.
And they were anything but that.
Yeah,
we're running out of time, but I want to get some ideas out of you before we do.
Yeah.
Do you have an overarching theme that you think that really comes through in your work?
Yeah, I think it's like dealing with time.
You think you're dealing with time, and it's a matter of representing time via the visceral.
Because it doesn't time doesn't seem to have any real parameters. I mean, nobody from St. Augustine on up could actually define it. Everybody knows it, but there's a whole class of people who don't believe in time and yet have to accept the fact that they get older every day when they look in a mirror.
Yeah, you know, time is a topic that we could speak for hours about, and I think that it's one that's fascinating. You've been listening to Turning of the Wheel. My name is Chris Lisher, and my guest today has been Paul Loffoli. Paul Loffoli is a remarkable contemporary visionary abstract painter from Boston, and he has a wonderful website which illustrates what he does. It's www.loffoli.com. It's L-A-F-F-O-L-E-Y. And he is the sole pioneer of the Boston Visionary Cell, which is a which is his work and his representation of work, and he's also represented by Kent Gallery in New York City. Now, Paul has been painting for 40, 50 years, and his paintings are absolutely remarkably elaborate. He's also working on a deck of tarot cards right now, or at least a set of cards that is very rich in visual dimension and in symbolism. And he basically deals with symbolism, and it's a very rich, complex, expertly rendered stuff that is just breathing. I don't think anybody could walk away from your painting. I think they'd be compelled to stand there and look at it for hours because of the richness and the depth that's there.
Well, some people have owned my stuff for over 20 years, and they say that that they're still finding things in it. You know, so it isn't like a lot of New York stuff. Like you can go into the meat market at 560 West Broadway, start at the top, and not actually have to leave the elevator. When the elevator door opens, you see a show. And you get it instantly, and you keep going down. So that within seconds, if you buy one, you start to get bored with it.
Yeah. Paul, we got to wrap it up. I think it looks fantastic. When I say it, I think you're plugged, like the world was plugged into you. I think that you are dramatically right about that. You're sort of a conduit for everything that's gone on. I appreciate you very much for coming on the show today, and I look forward to talking to you again. Good luck on your trip. It's been a marvelous time having you on. Thank you so much,
okay.
Paul.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah,
okay.
Take care. I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, bye now.
Very good. Bye-bye. Well, it's been wonderful having Paul LaFollette on. Go to www.lafollette.com and check out this man. He is an amazing genius. There's nothing else like it.
You may visit my website at www.chrisflisher.com. That's www.chrisflisher.com. Or email me, and you can call me at 508-517-0969. Thank you. And as always, be open to possibilities.